When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Daily for Monday, January 24th, 2022. On today's episode, we're going to discuss the latest film and TV news. This is Slash Film editorial director Peter Ceretta, and joining me on today's podcast is Slash Film news writer Ryan Scott.
Afternoon, everybody. How's it going?
How was your weekend, Ryan?
It was good. I guess probably the people that follow me on Twitter know this, but the one like weird thing that I love that is very outside the rest of my interests is football. So I watched a whole lot of NFL playoffs this weekend, and it was a damn good weekend in that respect. So,
yeah, there weren't really any big movies out this weekend, right?
Not new ones. We did have The Lost, or I think it was called The Lost Daughter, or the King's Daughter, which was
It may as well have been lost.
Right. It was supposed to be released in 2015, Pierce Brosnan movie. Now ranks as one of the worst openings ever for a wide release movie.
Yeah, I think probably the only thing worth mentioning box office-wise is Spider-Man No Way Home is officially now the fourth highest movie domestically of all time. And what is it worldwide?
It is now six worldwide. It passed Jurassic World and the Lion King remake, which is just amazing. And now the only thing, so it's almost at 1.7 billion. The only movies that have beat it at this point are movies that cross 2 billion worldwide, starting with Infinity War, which is at the number five spot. So whether or not it gets there, I think at this point you're starting to stretch, but at this point I wouldn't count it out. So
what about domestically? Because right now, Spider-Man No Way Home, at least as of a few days ago when this article was written, so it's probably higher now, was at 702 million. I'm assuming it's probably like 710 or 715 at this point or something. Number three on the domestic list is Avatar with 760. Do you think it's going to beat Avatar domestically?
That's where you start getting into like, again, same thing with like, does it get to 2 billion is like, you know, the only thing is, like, even still, because Morbius moved, we don't have anything big coming out next week. You know, I mean, the holds have been good. What does it need? Yeah, a little less than 40 million, especially if Sony does, like, a re-release at some point. But then also what you have to look at with Avatar, and I've talked about this before, is there's no way we're not going to get a re-release of Avatar before Avatar 2 comes out. And if you look at what the Avatar re-release made in China last year, it could make a lot. So, I don't know. It could be some back and forth there.
But we don't think it's going to make Avengers Endgame domestic money. That's like 850.
No, that's where you get out of the realm. And then also when you look at like, so that for people that don't know, the number one domestic grosser of all time is Star Wars The Force Awakens with 936 million. I don't think that record's ever getting touched, but
yeah. I think the only way that this could touch that is if they re-released it with like extra scenes or something. And maybe even then, I'm not even sure.
Look, I think like at this point you're just talking about like a whole lot of icing on a well-iced cake. You know, I don't know.
Yeah.
But yeah, so it's a hell of a thing.
Well, this past week, we've started to see some release date shift. Mission Impossible 7 and 8 have been delayed once again. They were scheduled to be released in September 2022 and July of 2023. And now the new dates are for Mission Impossible 7 is going to be released in July 14th, 2023. Basically taking about almost the same date as what the eighth movie was going to be. And Mission Impossible 8 is going to take, it was July 7th, 2023, and now it's in June 28th, 2024. So basically, both of those movies have been pushed back a year. And Paramount is saying, after careful thought, it's in response to delays due to the ongoing pandemic. And Paramount also shifting release dates for a bunch of their movies, but I think most notably A Quiet Place 3 was supposed to come out this in March of 2023, and is pushed to September 22nd, 2023. So pushed, what is that? Is that, I guess that's 6 months?
Although I should note, I think that's not actually A Quiet Place 3. That's the spinoff that the guy that directed Pig is directing. Like, it's not like a proper 3. It's more of a spinoff. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it just has that placeholder title.
But just in case audience members are like, oh, no, it's the spinoff they've been working on.
Yeah, and Transformers Rise of the Beasts is pushed from June 9th, 2023 to July 19th, 2024. So a whole year and some change.
But that movie got pushed 2 years in no time flat because that was supposed to be June of this year. So, like, that is crazy.
And that movie, I think it's done, right? Or
they finished filming. There's no reason it couldn't be released this year were it not for COVID. So why on earth it's not getting released next year is way beyond me.
I mean, it could be like, you know, there is production delays due to the pandemic and, you know, visual effects. Like, that is definitely a thing.
Yeah.
You know, everybody's working from home. But either that or that's a long time.
Either that or if I'm tinfoil hat here, maybe Paramount is very unhappy with what they've seen. We might be looking at reshoots, might be looking at, you know, because it feels like ever since Bumblebee came out, they have no idea what they want to do. So,
yeah, Paramount kind of lacks direction. I feel like out of all the studios right now, I can tell you what Disney is. Do you know what I mean? I can tell you, Paramount just like doesn't know what they're doing. And doesn't
Paramount
seem
is very
to...
lost right now because they're sort of got one foot in both camps. And I think it would be tough to them to fully commit to streaming because I don't think they have the juice for it. And I also think it's tough for them to abandon streaming because I think they're losing some of their bigger franchise stuff. So, like, you know, I don't know. I think if there's any, like, major studio that might end up either, like, losing out in the streaming wars, they are starting to kind of hedge their bets, man.
Yeah, I think at this point they need to like actually align with one of the other streaming services and, you know, have Paramount. I mean, Paramount Plus is good. I mean, I'm watching Survivor on it. I'm watching Australian Survivor.
I think at this point what's more likely to happen is like everyone else is going to watch and see some blood in the water and wait for someone to fail and then like kind of go acquire like sort of, you know, so I think right now, if we're going to do, like, a power rankings, I think Paramount is kind of sort of lower. I think Sony's weirdly playing very smart baseball right now by not having a streaming service. And, I don't know. Paramount seems to be maybe the most vulnerable, I think.
I mean, do all the studios really need a streaming service, I guess, is my question. Because, like, Sony, I think, could gain a lot of money just like selling Spider-Man to Disney Plus for the foreseeable future.
That's exactly what they're doing, and they're making the most of the franchises they have. They're cutting deals with streaming services. Like, the one thing I wish they hadn't done was sell Mitchells versus the Machines to Netflix, because I feel like that could have been a very theatrically viable movie. But Netflix or Sony's playing smart ball by sort of being the now content provider to these streaming services that desperately need it, you know, like, because now there's no funnel. It's literally they're left to their own devices. So Sony's playing smart ball. I agree. I don't think Sony doesn't need it right now. Right now, God knows what happens in the future. But
let's talk about this theatrical release dates for a second. Is this a matter of Paramount not being confident in the next year? Or are we going to see a lot more release dates get pushed back?
I got to be honest. The Mission Impossible ones surprised me. I do think that, like, most, if you look at, like, long-range box office analysis, most people believe 2023 is when we'll get back to, like, the closest normal. To normal that we'll ever get. Like, it might not be, like, full normal again, but it'll be closer. Because even if you look at like what happened with Scream this week, where if you're not Spider-Man No Way Home, the new normal is you get one weekend and then you fall off of a cliff. So, like, you know, if you have a $150 million movie that needs to make its money back, I would say even Mission Impossible 7, who knows? Top Gun Maverick, who knows? You know, like, so I think maybe they're sort of like, I guess maybe they're playing long ball and that they're hoping in like 2023, 2024, they can get the most juice out of what they know they have.
You don't think this is like a March 2020 situation where we're going to start seeing other studios, you know, start pushing their dates?
I think because you've already seen Omicron is peaking in some areas already and it's going to decline. Yeah. So I think what's going to happen is this is going to start to establish the flu season of COVID, right? Where like every like December to February, we're going to have like COVID season. And so I think what you're going to start seeing is like less big movies, less big events happening on those months. And then you'll just kind of see like the entire entertainment industry restructure itself around like a March to November timeline. So I think you might see some release date shuffling, but I think the problem is there's too much overcrowding with the release dates right now. So a lot of people are going to have to sort of commit, to what they have. And I think Paramount's just moving off because those are their bread and butter franchises. Like anything else they have on the calendar this year, I bet stays, but.
Yeah, in the next month, I don't think we have anything like huge. Like we have Jackass Forever and Moonfall, which
that is going to be the best movie going weekend of my life, and I'm not even fucking kidding.
But I'm guessing. I'm not trying to judge any group of people, but I'm guessing the audiences for those movies probably are not like, I'm going to stay home because I don't want to be in a movie theater that weekend.
Well, like for instance, I will fight my own mother to go see Jackass. Like I am so deeply, it was one of my top three most anticipated movies of the year, and I'm not even sort of kidding. So I am very excited.
Yeah, and later in February we have Uncharted, which I'm not sure how that's going to do. And early March we got The Batman. I don't see those moving.
Can I make a bold prediction?
Sure.
Uncharted is going to be one of the biggest box office flops of the year.
I don't think that's a bold prediction, to be honest with you.
But let's circle back to this because I don't know, but I think it's going to be one of the I think it's going to flop bad. Big bad. Bad. So.
We'll see. Okay. Well, more about Paramount. Paramount's not only losing their release date here, but they are also losing Skydance Media, who is the company behind Mission Impossible and.
Yeah.
Do you want to tell us about that?
Yeah. So this was one. I think I sort of snuck this into our Slack channel this week. Where like, I think if I hadn't sort of pointed it out, I don't know if everyone would have thought it was as big of a deal. Maybe I'm taking more credit for that than I deserve, but so Skydance, if people don't know, has been like this really prolific production company for the last like decade or so, you know, sort of again behind the Mission Impossible movies, behind the Terminator franchise, behind they have the new Top Gun, and some of the Transformers films and Star Trek, and so they also have some originals and stuff, but they started shifting towards streaming last year, like they did The Old Guard for Netflix, Without Remorse and The Tomorrow War got sold to Amazon. So I think during COVID, they sort of realized that like, you know, okay, we had some movies flop theatrically. Like we had Gemini Man flop pretty bad. We had, you know, Terminator Dark Fate didn't do what we wanted. So they have now made a deal with Apple, an exclusive first look deal with Apple. And they are going to produce several, it is not clear how many, wide appeal movies, live action movies every year for Apple. Now, the obvious implication is that these will go to Apple TV Plus. It does not explicitly say that they will not get theatrically released. But the big loser here, as we were talking about a minute ago, is Paramount. Because Paramount had the first look deal with Skydance for the last decade. Now, important to note that Skydance and Paramount will still have the option to co-finance future entries in like the Mission Impossible or Star Trek franchises. But beyond that, Apple gets first bite now. So kind of a big blow to theatrical and a kind of a huge win for Apple the way I see it.
Oh yeah, for sure. They already like, I don't know. It felt like a weird deal anyways, because it felt like they were co-producing all the Bad Robot stuff for Paramount. And then when Bad Robot and JJ, you know, went over to Warner Brothers, they were kind of, I don't know. It felt like, what are they doing at Paramount now? Apple, it's going to be interesting because Apple is doing a lot of, how do I put this? Like highbrow in terms of their movies and programming.
Yeah, well, they
and
have
Skydance
like,
has always been like Skydance is by David Ellison, who is the brother of Megan Ellison, who runs Annapurna, and she's doing all this very highbrow stuff. But David has always been trying to do sci-fi and blockbuster stuff. So I think that's what Apple's been missing.
Apple's, and now I made that point in my article, Apple's totally missing that because they have, you know, Apple, because Apple TV Plus is a loss leader for them. Apple doesn't care if Apple TV Plus makes money. They care that it brings people to the Apple brand so they can sell more shit. You know, like, and which is fine, but that actually isn't a terrible business model for the consumer because, you know, they can continue to make good stuff and they don't necessarily have to care that it in itself generates money. Like Amazon's that same way. But like, so they have like, you know, Tragedy of Macbeth, they're getting a Coen Brothers movie up there. You know, you're getting your Killers of the Flower Moon from Scorsese. What they're missing is like a Geostorm. Like, you know, your or Life or you know, or a World War Z. These are all Skydance movies. These are the types of things that a Skydance can bring to you.
Well, also Skydance was trying to get into the animation business. They were launching their own animation studio. I know back when John Lasseter left Pixar and Disney, he was going to oversee that. I'm not sure. Is he still over
Is that still in the Hollywood Reporter article about the Skydance deal? It made a note that Apple has already, you know, partnered with Skydance on some animation projects, and John Lasseter's name was still in there. So, like, you know, that's something. You know, I mean, that's
I thought for sure that that might fall out after, you know, the reports were, like, not very positive about that.
Seems like they're being quiet about it, at least. And the thing is, like, as a moviegoer, I mean, I really like what Skydance does. Like, I really like where they operate. Like, they take some interesting chances and, you know, and they do, like, I mean, you know, you even look at something like Life, which, you know, didn't do great, but, like, a really fun original sci-fi movie, I thought, you know, or, like, Gemini Man, which I really wish had been made for less money because, like, that was a great 90s action movie that just happened to exist in 2019. But I like what Skydance does. My hope is that Apple... And I have a thing I'm going to be writing for us shortly, but I hope Apple commits to theatrical a bit, because like they're not, because again it's a loss leader for them. They don't care about exclusivity. I think Apple cares more about getting good filmmakers on board, and you can do that if you promise a theatrical release. So
I think that that's their priority. So I think if the filmmakers want to do theatrical, like, you know, Rian Johnson wanted to do theatrical with Knives Out 2, and Netflix is actually kind of the opposite of Apple. They want the exclusivity and stuff like that, but they're willing to do that to, you know, appease Rian Johnson. I think that's going to be like Apple. It's like, yeah, you want to do a theatrical? We want to do theatrical. We want the Oscars too. Do you know what I mean?
Okay, but I think Netflix giving Knives Out 2 a theatrical release, I'm going to be interested to see what that really means. Is it going to be like one weekend of a wide release and then whatever, or like... You know, are they really going to give it a shot? Because I don't think they will. I think Apple has. I think Apple, on the other hand, might actually give movies a real shot in theaters at some point.
See, I would disagree with you there because I don't think there's any way. Knowing Rian Johnson, when I first moved to LA, I had this like lunch with Rian, and he was telling me like he moved to LA, and where he moved to LA was in. I don't think he lives there anymore, but was in a close proximity to the New Beverly Theater. Because he loved that's how much he loved film and the New Beverly Theater.
Yeah.
You know, that's how he chose where he was going to live. And he's such a seeing movies in the theater and film guy. I don't know. I feel like whatever deal he signed with Netflix, it had heavy wording of like how many weeks they needed to get in, how many theaters.
That really did shock me when he, I mean, when he moved to Netflix, but then the amount of money they paid for those two, I mean, my God, I don't know if people really understand, like, the amount of money that Netflix paid for those two Knives Out movies is genuinely staggering.
They overpaid. Like, there's almost no way that those movies were going to make that much money back.
No, but Netflix did it to take a theatrically viable franchise off the table.
Yeah.
They overpaid for strategic dickhead reasons. Like, you know, like in today's edition of Netflix is an asshole. Like, you know, like it was, you know, that.
But
one.
Also Netflix has quality issues. They have quantity. They don't have the quality. This gives them some quality. So
is that why they did it? That's not why they did it. They did not do it for that. They did it so Lionsgate can bleed out, and then at some point someone can buy Lionsgate. That's what they did.
But on the positive end of things, Rian Johnson's getting paid finally. So
I love Knives Out. I love almost everything Rian Johnson's done. I'm just mad as someone who loves it that I wished it had, stayed theatrically viable. But anyway.
Yeah. Okay, we should move on. We have so much stuff to talk about because we haven't had a news episode in a week. There's a MonsterVerse TV series coming from Apple TV Plus. Why don't you tell us about that?
Sure as hell is. There is no news story from the last week that had me asking more questions than this. So for those that are not familiar with the MonsterVerse branding, this is the franchise name given to the 2014 Godzilla, Kong Skull Island, Godzilla King of the Monsters, and Godzilla vs. Kong, that universe. Legendary is behind this franchise, and they have partnered with Warner Brothers for the movies. Well, now we have word that a MonsterVerse TV series that is untitled is in development with Legendary at Apple TV Plus, not HBO Max, which is owned by Warner Media. Very peculiar. As far as details go, you have Chris Black, who's involved in Star Trek Enterprise, involved, as well as Matt Fraction, who wrote the Hawkeye comics that largely inspired the series on Disney Plus, working on the show. There is a brief
By the way, he's an amazing creator. If you have not read any of Matt Fraction's work, not even just his Marvel work, but even like his work in comics in general, this excites me more than it being on Apple TV Plus.
Fraction is so good. He genuinely, if you find his byline somewhere, go check it out. There is a very brief synopsis for this, which says, following the thunderous battle between Godzilla and the Titans that leveled San Francisco and the shocking new reality that monsters are real, the series explores one family's journey to uncover its buried secrets and a legacy linking them to the secret organization known as Monarch. So that's what we're looking at, kids. And questions, please.
This is very interesting. I'm excited to see what this is. There is another MonsterVerse TV show set up at Netflix, I think. It's an animated thing.
Oh, well, Netflix did a couple of the Godzilla animes and stuff, but I don't know. I don't know if it's officially
Is the thing I'm thinking of not
I don't think it's tied to the actual MonsterVerse, but for this, Peter, help me out because I have not been able to bounce this out. Why on earth did this go to Apple and not HBO Max? I have my own crackpot theories. Do you have any thoughts about this?
I don't have any. No, I don't. Let's hear your thoughts.
Well, I mean, so my first thought is this show is going to be tremendously expensive. I mean, I don't know how you make a Godzilla TV show without it being tremendously expensive.
Yeah.
So I don't know if it was just too rich for Warner Brothers. I doubt that, because they are perfectly happy to spend money on stuff that doesn't make money. But my other thought is that Legendary was pretty upset with the Godzilla vs. Kong streaming release. I know that Warner Brothers sort of amended that, they paid some money to Legendary, but I still feel like they were upset about it, so I'm wondering if this was their middle finger to them to say, okay, we'll take our business elsewhere. That's my only thought, though. Other than that, I find it weird.
I think that's right. I do have the answer here, Ryan.
Okay,
It's a Skull Island anime series.
That's right.
So I'm not sure if that's canon with the MonsterVerse, but that definitely pulls in from Skull Island and tells some stuff from King Kong and stuff like that. So I don't know. Do they include that part of the MonsterVerse? I don't know.
I mean, Legendary would obviously have to be behind it, but I think there's a gigantic difference between we're making an animated show versus we're going to, you want to play guess the budget on a MonsterVerse TV show? I don't know how you get that made for less than $100 million conservatively. you know. Yeah. So
well,
like,
Apple certainly has that money, so right. Go to them.
But so that's what I'm saying. So that's a big difference between. But again, I don't know why Warner Brothers. I don't know. It's just still that boy. I'd like to hear. I can't wait till someone spills some tea about that because man, that's.
Yeah, but I'm definitely excited about this, as I am excited in March, The Batman is coming out, and we now know how long it's going to be. It's going to be nearly 3 hours long. Yeah. It's 175 minutes. If you don't count the serials, which were released, you know, episodically, I don't really consider those movies, or you don't count the director's cut, like, you know, that were released on DVD or Zack Snyder's Justice League. Out of the 19 Batman movies, this is going to be the longest one released so far. It's interesting. We did this write up on the site from Whitney, and it's mentioned here that there's this like study. I'm sure you have something to say about this. There was a study in 2018 from this website, Towards Data Science, which conducted and sought out the average lengths of all feature films going back to 1911. And they used IMDb as their data set. TDS found that over the course of history, the highest number of movies only ran between 90 and 100 minutes. Or as any person over 35 might say, a good length. The data shows that films, while getting ever so slightly longer in general, are still averaging out in the classic 80 minutes to 130 minute range. But what we are seeing, however, is the length of the blockbuster genre entertainment. Like in 1966, 104 minutes was epic. You know, 2022, 175 minutes isn't even the longest superhero movie of the last few years. So, it definitely seems like things are getting longer. Do you have any idea, like, any thoughts on why?
Yeah, I got a few. I mean, I think part of it is that, like, you're, especially with this Batman movie, because it's not attached to the pre-existing universe, it's setting up an entire universe. They already have two spin-off shows in the works at HBO Max. Matt Reeves has already talked about how he wants to do a trilogy. Clearly setting up a whole other damn universe that Warner Brothers can use, and that's got to accomplish a lot. You know, like, I don't know. I have thoughts, like my thing is, like, what's that quote? You know, a bad movie's never short enough, and a good movie's never long enough, or something like that. Like, you know, like, Heat is my favorite 3-hour movie. It doesn't feel like 3 hours long. Like, Heat sails by. But, you know, I think it's an exception, not the rule. I think a lot of times, like, movies, for me, if you get a little over 2 hours, every minute better be, like, heavily justified. Matt Reeves is one of my favorite directors working today. I have every bit of faith that this movie's going to be great. I don't know, like, 3 hours for a, it's just a lot. It's a lot. I don't know.
But I mean, like, what, Avatar was long, right? Was it 2.5 hours or something? It's definitely over the 2-hour time limit.
Yeah, but we're talking about movies that were good. So, like, I don't, you know.
Ouch.
Look, Avatar visually impressive, but my God, like, does anyone really care now?
I liked it. I like it.
But no, so I don't know. But, I think. Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, it's weird because it felt like in the 80s and 90s, the thought was from studios, let's make these big blockbuster things as short as possible so we can crank out as many showings in the day, because if we have more showings in the day on opening weekend, we're going to make more money. And it just seems to me in the last, like, 10, 15 years, maybe even longer than that, maybe 20 years, it seems to be the obvious. If you look at, like, some of the biggest films released in that time, they've all been, like, over 2 hours.
Well over. But I think the thing is, though, that, like, the movies that have done really well, Avatar, Avengers Endgame, Avengers Infinity War, now Spider-Man No Way Home, 2.5 to 3 hours does not kneecap you at the box office if you can take over every single available screen, which happens because theaters want the money, and the demand is there. The demand will be there for the Batman. So, like, you know, I think as long as the movie's good, people will sit through 3 hours. It's just the idea that, like, I don't think that, like, that should be the goalpost for, Because I also think you're competing with binge watching on like streaming now. So in some ways, audiences are trained to sit down for longer for things. So I feel like a 3-hour movie maybe isn't as much of a challenge in that way. But I don't know. Like,
I do think there's something there to that, because like in screenwriting, or any kind of storytelling, if you only have an hour and a half, you only have a certain time to set up, you know, the characters, the inciting incident, the obstacles, then the leading to the conflict of the great third act, tentpole action scene. Like, there's not much room there to really explore the themes and ideas and characters that you have in these TV shows now. And I really think that you need to go beyond those 2 hours to do that in any substantial way at this point.
Cool. Then make a Batman TV show. I don't know. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know. Like,
I'm sure they will. I'm sure they will. I mean, they are.
It is me, Ryan Scott, the embittered moviegoer who is tired of everything being streaming and tired. Like, I just want movies to be allowed to be movies and not have to. I'm a little concerned that this 3-hour runtime is very clearly going to be pulling a lot of taffy to set up other stuff.
We also ran a report that the first test screening of this film was test screened by Warner Brothers at 4 hours. So you hear all the time, like, you know, the first cut of this film was 5 hours or 4 hours.
Yeah, yeah.
That's usually the assembly cut. That's not like a cut that anybody would actually see. This is the first cut then, like, you know, doesn't have multiple takes of stuff, multiple jokes, you know, whatever. This is like the first actual cut of the film was 4 hours, and he got it down to under 3 hours. So I don't know. I just wonder, like, why are these studios allowing people to make a 4-hour movie?
Well, because, but I think in this case, like,
yeah,
Warner Brothers was absolutely shackled to the idea of needing to get a Batman movie made, because you got to understand, by the time this hits theaters, it will have been just shy of a full decade since a solo Batman movie has hit theaters. You know, it's their biggest property. Like, you are absolutely needing this to happen. And they absolutely definitely thought Matt Reeves was the guy. So you do what he wants. Yeah. You know, and like, again, the idea is if in that 3-hour runtime, you can get two sequels set up with two or three HBO Max shows, you know, that's the way that you justify that 3-hour movie. And there's no way the movie's not going to make money. So, like, you know, I just wish that what didn't have to be the case. Like, The Dark Knight
There's only a handful of directors that I feel like I would be happy with a 3-hour long Batman movie. And I think Matt Reeves is one of them. So, and Matt Reeves, we trust.
I will follow Matt Reeves anywhere he goes. And like, and I've made no bones about it. I don't care about Batman, but I do like the world that he inhabits. I wish Matt Reeves was doing anything but a Batman movie, but I'm very excited to see what he does with a Batman movie.
Okay, we're already over our 30-minute time limit, but can we still talk about this, Ryan?
We can talk about anything you want to talk, Peter. Whatever you want to talk.
Okay, this is a big story that hit last week. This is something I've known about for a month, but I couldn't talk about. Mary Elizabeth Winstead has entered the Star Wars universe. Do you want to tell us about that, Ryan?
Yeah, so Mary Elizabeth Winstead, star of such films as 10 Cloverfield Lane and Scott Pilgrim vs. the World, going to be joining the Ahsoka series here on Disney Plus, a Star Wars show that will star Rosario Dawson reprising her role as Ahsoka Tano from The Mandalorian. As is always the case, no word on who she's playing, plot details being kept secret, but weirdly enough, this makes for a Death Proof reunion. Which I did not realize at the time that I wrote this story, and I felt silly about it, but that's what's happening.
Huh. I didn't even think about that.
Our own Jeff Ewing, pointed that out to me on Twitter later, and I was like, damn it. Very cool casting. I love her. No idea. My feeling is I could see her in like a Chiss Ascendancy uniform. You know, no idea. Wild speculation at this point.
I will say that, you know, after Star Wars Rebels aired, there was a lot of, when I was looking up information about Mary Elizabeth Winstead in Star Wars, she never really like mentioned Star Wars in an interview or anything like that, but there's a lot of, when I Googled it, there was a lot of fan castings. People wanted her to play Sabine Wren in a movie or TV show. That's not happening because there's already someone cast probably as Sabine, and obviously Mary is white and you want someone of color, you know, in that role.
I also just don't think she's a good fit for that part. Like, that's my part. Like, I think that she's better to.
Well, you know what it is? It's like people see what they've seen and they put the person in a box. So sure, she had colored hair in Scott Pilgrim, and they're like, oh, she would work for Sabine because she has colored hair, what goes on. But what about Hera? I think she might be a good fit for Hera. I don't know anything, but like I was looking at pictures of her and I was looking at pictures at Hera, and I could see her being with the what do you call those?
The tendrils?
Yeah.
But my thing with Hera, so Star Wars Rebels is very beloved to me. And we're talking about a weird space show here, so it's not like it needs to line up, but I feel like age-wise, Mary Elizabeth Winstead is already too young to play Hera as we saw her, and I feel like Hera would be older now, but she's also a green alien, so does that even matter? I feel that was my thought, and I mentioned that in my article, but I also was like, at the same time, I'm like, am I being ridiculous? But the
other thing I want to mention, which I don't think is going to happen, but if you look at some pictures of Mary Elizabeth Winstead in like some white clothing, she does have that Carrie Fisher Princess Leia look going on.
Oh,
you just made a face on we can see each other's faces here, and you just made a face of like,
no. Because also, like, what business would Leia have in that show?
Yeah, I don't know.
Like, I'm all aboard the Sebastian Stan as Luke train just because he looks the part and there's a reason to... But, like, at this point now you have a reason to have a younger Luke Skywalker actor. Like, until we have a good reason to have a younger Leia actor, I don't know. And also the difference is, like, Carrie Fisher's no longer with us. Mark Hamill is, and he could be there to sort of, like, pass the torch. So, I don't know. I feel like there's a bit of a different, like... That sits differently with me, I guess.
How old was Carrie Fisher when she filmed A New Hope or, like, Return of the Jedi?
Oh, you were really going to start doing this math to make this work?
She was 19 in 1976. Jesus. So I guess she was 25-ish when Return of the Jedi.
So that, and then 6 years after that, so early 30s, early to mid-30s.
And Mary Elizabeth Winstead is the mid-30s.
God damn it.
So... it could work. It could. Okay, I honestly don't believe that to be the case.
No, it's don't either. But you're making this work, and I don't like it.
Okay. We need to end this here because I know you got to go back and work. But I did want before we go to ask you about this. You got to interview the Fraggles.
I sure as hell did. So, like, I know a couple weeks ago we talked about what I thought at the time was the coolest thing I've ever done for us with the Darth Plagueis article, but, like, I talked to actual Fraggles, and so you can go on /film right now, and the article is called An Intimate Conversation with the Fraggles from Fraggle Rock Back to the Rock, which is now on Apple TV+, and might I add, a very delightful sort of revival of the show. But they offered us some interviews, and two of those interviews were with, like, actual, like, Muppet performers performing the Fraggles on camera, like, fully committed to the bit, not understanding that they're in a TV show. So, like, I interviewed, like, real deal Fraggles, and it was...
Were you given rules before you interviewed them?
Not, like, rules so much as they, like, sent us a sheet of being like, hey, like, more to warn us, like, this is how seriously they're taking this, so if you ask them about being in a TV show, they're not gonna understand what you're asking them. You know, like, that sort of stuff. And then, like... And then the only thing is it was just, like, because there was, like, puppet performers, like, you know, they're like, hey, address them by name so they know who you're talking to. That was really the only rule we had, you know, like it was.
Oh, yeah, because you were on a video call with all of them at the same time.
Well, there was, so one was with, I think it was Gobo, Boober, and Red, and then the other one was with Moki and Wembley. So I had a couple, at least a couple in each. And kind of had to, like, determine who you were talking to. I broke that rule a few times anyway, but, just if you're in the mood for something just incredibly delightful, I would say that you know, that's the way to go. Check that out today.
Okay, you can find that link. You can find links to all the stories we talked about in today's podcast in the show notes. You can find this podcast on Apple, Google, Overcast, Spotify, all the popular podcast apps. Please feel free to send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and Mary Elizabeth Winstead speculation to peter@slashfilm.com. And please rate and review this podcast on Apple Podcasts. Tell your friends, spread the word, and we'll see you tomorrow. Cool.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.